Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotet in Washington, D.C.
After the election, that they would stage a fight, a serious fight against corruption.
Mauritius' new government makes the fight against corruption a key issue in keeping with its campaign in the run-up to last year's election.
One, Kampala is oversubscribed in terms of leadership, and there is no clear system on how these different power centers can coordinate. Each one, they are operating in a silo, and there is overlap, there is confusion, and so on and so forth. So,
the new executive director of the Kampala Capital City Authority promises to tackle the capital city's waste management crisis.
And essentially, I'm not hoping to say it is KMO who's going to be in office, but the Gambia is 65% young people. So we are hoping that at least we should be able to have a youth candidate representing us.
And a prominent environmentalist plans to lead a youth movement as part of an effort to run in next year's presidential contest in the Gambia. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Mauritius, the chairperson of the Media Trust says the newly elected government has made the fight against corruption a priority in keeping with its campaign in the run-up to last year's election. Ashok B. Harry is the chairperson of Media Trust, an organization whose mission is training and capacity building for media professionals. He also says there are high expectations for an inquiry into allegations of corruption in the previous administration. This after the police issued a notice of arrest for former Finance Minister Renganaden Padayachi in relation to a probe into alleged embezzlement. Reuters News says the announcement issued in a police notice in local newspapers comes days after the arrest of the former central bank governor. For more on the fight against financial malfeasance and wrongdoing, I reached Ashok B. Harry, chairperson of the Media Trust.
And one of the priorities of the new government, as they have been telling during the campaign, the electoral campaign and after the election, that they would stage a fight, a serious fight against corruption. A new governor of the Bank of Mauritius was appointed, and the new governor, what he did at the very start of his functions, he made a review of money allocated by an entity owned by the Bank of Mauritius known as the Mauritius Investment Corporation, MIC, which was set up with capital from the Bank of Mauritius. Billions of rupees were put in this entity and in this vehicle, investment vehicle, during the COVID period to support private companies who were in financial trouble or difficulty. And there were billions of rupees, as I said, invested by the Bank of Mauritius. But the review made by the new governor revealed that there was some doubtful or fraudulent activities. That is, there are some companies who have benefited money without, giving the proper guarantee.
B. Harry, the question people are asking is the recent development a signal of the intentions or plans of the new administration to fight corruption?
Indeed, one of the main themes of the electoral campaign was the fight against corruption, against fraud, because there were. But at this stage, what I would say, these are allegations yet to be proven. But the police are doing their work. The authorities have put a lot of energy and a lot of attention on this fight, and this is only the tip of the iceberg, according to sources, because it is being rumored, it is being alleged that there are other cases of corruption or fraudulent operations in many other sectors. And the new prime minister, as well as the new government, They have promised to clear the air and to clean the country, and they have done it very right away after the election. They have started the inquiry. They have started probing into various allegations, and we expect that in the coming days, in the coming weeks, the police will be conducting a lot of inquiries, which would eventually lead to arrests, and people those who are found guilty, of course, will be jailed.
Human rights defenders are expressing worry that if care is not taken, there could be excesses, and there could also be witch hunt for those who perhaps might not have involved themselves in acts of corruption or financial malfeasance in Mauritius. What is your take? What is the general mood in the country about the fight against corruption?
You know, there have been these practices have been denounced by the former opposition, which is now in power. So they have the Prime Minister in his message during the New Year has clearly affirmed that they would not have recourse to such practices. Everything will be done according to the law, in strict legality, in strict respect of the laws and of human rights. And if, in fact, we have seen that the police have been doing their work, I must say, in a very respectful and fair manner. And the government, the new government, the new Prime Minister, has given the assurance that there will be no witch hunt, but people who have been who are found or who against whom there are allegations of ill doings, they will have, of course, to be taken to task.
Bihari, what are the expectations of the people of Mauritius, particularly when it comes to the fight against corruption?
The people want to see that the culprit are condemned and are put to jail. This is the you know, the what you can read, what you can see from the social networks, that people want to see people who are you know, guilty of ill doings, they have to bear the consequences. So the people want to see things being done rapidly. But the government has made it clear that they don't want to rush. They want to do everything in strict adherence to the laws of the country.
Ashok Bihari is the chairperson of the Media Trust. He spoke with me from the Mauritius capital, Port Louis. In Uganda, the newly installed executive director of the Kampala's Capital City Authority, or the KCCA, is promising to tackle the capital city's waste management crisis. Hajat Sharifa Buzeki described Kampala as having a great potential. He has also vowed to implement measures to transform the city by addressing challenges including traffic chaos, potholes, and uncollected garbage. But Erias Lukwago, the Lord Mayor of Kampala, has expressed concern that previous KCCA leaders did not prioritize the interests and needs of the majority of the city's residents. Lukwago's critics often accuse him of failing to tackle the challenges facing the city. But he tells me that the accusations are politically motivated and not a true reflection of the facts on the ground. He also talks about the working relationship he expects to have with a new executive director.
Well, to begin with, it will depend on the debriefing that was given to her by the appointing authority. You know, he subscribed to the opposition and he's been a president for the last 40 years. And he has got issues with me. Of course, he has not hidden this. On several occasions, he has come out to say the people of Kampala committed suicide electing me as the Lord Mayor. And the reason he has not been bankrolling our projects is precisely to stifle my government, to ensure that we do not get credit for whatever transformation that may come about in Kampala, just to use it for political reasons, to say, look here, the opposition has failed you. It's basically that politics. So if she steers clear of that kind of politics, probably there will be some point of intersection.
In one of your conversations, you expressed concern about a dysfunctional Kampala city. What do you mean by that, especially when the executive has been inaugurated?
Well, the structure of Kampala is like an amoeba. It has no shape at all. You see, you have so many power centers. You have the office of the Lord Mayor with mandate clearly stipulated under the law. you've got a whole horde of proxies sent by General Kaguta Museveni to represent the central government with different assignments. You have two ministers, you have a big number of RCCs with the deputies, those are resident state commissioners, you have these technical people, they are big numbers, 10 directors, 10 deputies, 2 executive directors, and so a couple of other appointees from the central government. So you'd find one Kampala is oversubscribed in terms of leadership, and there is no clear system on how these different power centers can coordinate. Each one, they are operating in a silo, and there is overlap, there is confusion, and so on and so forth. So that is the kind of situation I was explaining, that you have a dysfunctional institution with no clear chain of command, with so many actors, and of course with no clear instrument to direct the transformation journey, because you must be having a structural plan which is non-existent. And you may be shocked to find that we don't even have an organogram describing the structure of the institution of KCCA. So we have a very unique system which you'll not find anywhere in any city, anywhere in the world.
What do you say to some of your critics who say that you are to blame for the lack of development in the capital city, poor infrastructure, that you as Lord Mayor has failed in your duty to ensure Kampala City represent Uganda as a republic? How do you respond to that?
That is a narrative driven by General Kaguta Museveni for political reasons, obviously. But they know the truth. I mean, you cannot have a functional city without a functional administrative structure. And the resultant effect is a dysfunctional city. That is one. Two, the budget we are getting. You see, for me to carry out a meaningful transformation in the city, there must be clear funding. You can imagine even the semblance of some facelift on the infrastructure we have. It cuts off the donor community, the development partners, World Bank, the French Development Agency, Africa Development Bank. Those interventions they have made are the ones that are giving us some small facelift in Kampala. But the key sectors here are not funded at all. The local government, I mean the statutory transfers which are supposed to come from the national coffers are just peanuts. So if you have that kind of situation, and essentially, by the way, ours is a consumption budget, the one given to us by the central government on account of the statutory transfers and the local revenues, it's largely a consumption to deal with the wage bill, nothing else. So how do you transform Kampala into a functional city with that kind of financial structure? I think whatever they are saying is just a political gimmick. They are using me as a scapegoat to explain their failures for the last 40 years.
Attorney Arias Lukwago is the Lord Mayor of Kampala. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In Tanzania, the Director of Protocol, Communications and Foreign Affairs of the main opposition group Chadema is promising that the group will emerge stronger than before after its internal elections later this month. The party will elect representatives to prepare Chadema for Tanzania's general election in October. John Mrema says the vote will demonstrate the group's commitment to democracy and respect for the constitution. Longtime Chadema chairman Freeman Mbowe is expected to face a stiff challenge from his deputy Tundu Lissu, who was presidential candidate of the party in the last general election. The outcome of the internal poll, some analysts say, could create divisions and subsequently weaken the party. But John Bremer tells me that Chadema will remain strong and unified after the polls.
In this general, we're expecting to hold the national leaders' election, which is going to start on January, from the party wings, youth wing, women wing, and elderly wing. And then from 20th, we'll be holding the party leaders' national convention. And the climax is going to be on 21st of January this year, when we are expecting to get a new national chairman of the party, together with his two vice chairmen of the party, one from the mainland and the second one from Zanzibar. So the climax is going to be on the 21st of January this year.
I'm sure you've heard some analysts saying that Chadema's decision to hold internal election this year is high risk, which could either positively boost your chances during the coming general election or perhaps hurt if there are divisions that come out of the internal election. So what is your take?
We've heard those critics from the analysts that who are expecting maybe we are going to have a split in the party, but as of now, and I'm saying this from out of the experience, as a party, we are going to get out more stronger than ever before. And this election is going to test our strength. How strong are we as an institution? And that's why we are still stronger till this moment, although the campaigns are in a very high gear, because it's an election which is going to see one side. The national leadership of Freeman Mbowe is protesting against his deputy or the vice chairman, Honorable Tundu Lissu. These are two giants within our party. They are contesting together for the same position. But what I can tell you is that we are expecting to come out stronger more than ever before, and we are not going to split.
What makes you such confident in spite of the skepticism being expressed by some political analysts in Tanzania?
I have this confidence because I know our party members, our party leaders, how passionate they are when it comes to the matter of the party. Members of the National Convention, in any way, they are not going to allow this party to split, because they've been in this struggle for so many years. They have gone through several difficult times. So every one of them, when you speak to them, their message is very clear that we have to elect one and remain this a strong party. If anyone thinks that he or she can split this party, that time has not come yet. That's why I have this confidence, because it's the feedback we are getting from our members from the grassroots. And as you know, we've been in a party grassroots fortification for the last 2 years from the grass or from the roots itself, which we call Msingi. And our people, our members, every one of them, they are, when it comes to the issue of splitting the party, nobody will support that matter. And that's why I'm confident that we are going to come out stronger than ever before.
Ahead of the internal elections, what do you think the message is from Chadema to all the supporters across Tanzania?
Our message is going to be stronger together. That's our key message.
John Mrema is the Director of Protocol, Communications and Foreign Affairs of the Tanzanian opposition group Chadema. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. In Malawi, civil society groups, including the National Alliance Against Corruption and the Center for Social Accountability and Transparency, are calling on the government to expedite the appointment of a new Director General of the Anti-Corruption Bureau, or the ACB. This after expressing concern that failing to appoint a substantive head of the agency for more than 6 months hinders the war against graft. The contract of Martha Chizuma, the former ACB Director General, expired in May 2024. Hilary Chilomba is currently the acting head until the government determines who becomes the next leader of the anti-graft agency. Moses Nkandewire is the chairperson of the National Alliance Against Corruption. He tells me that the delay in appointing a new chief of the Anti-Corruption Bureau is undermining the efforts to combat corruption and wrongdoing.
It's unfortunate that the position has remained vacant since then, and this is negatively impacting on the fight against corruption in the country. So it's quite true what you have said.
But you have an acting director in the person of Chilomba. Are you saying that without a substantive director general of the anti-corruption, bureau, the fight against corruption, has been weakened?
Yes, because you know what? That position is not substantive, as we have already alluded to. And it might be difficult when it comes to providing a proper dilation, as well as ensuring that you are independent in your decisions. A reason being that sometimes what happens if maybe somebody who's in the government is actually involved in corruption? Would you think you can really act independently and then maybe arrest or investigate that particular person? The answer definitely is no, because you'll be waiting for your name to be nominated to go to parliament for approval. So you are afraid, basically, that those individuals might not take your name to the National Assembly. So that's the danger that we see. And that's why I would want to have a substantive, you know, kind of position.
Well, there are some Malawians who are of the view that the government's decision to be thorough in selecting the new anti-corruption bureau director general is in the right place, especially since Martha Chizume's stay in that office elicited or generated some controversy. So it is important to ensure that the next director is without blemish and anticipated controversy. Your thoughts?
Unfortunately, that's not the case. I think for some of us, Martha is a person that brought in some kind of integrity because of her personal, you know, lifestyle, her personal, you know, integrity that she has, and she brought in that kind of, you know, image into that organization. So to claim today that there was some kind of controversy, I don't think that those kind of controversies were actually caused by Martha, but I think they were caused by some individuals who were afraid of the campaign, you know, and how transparent, you know, the lady was in that position. So I think let's not bring in the kind of fear into all these processes. Secondly, I don't think that anybody would come up with any kind of an excuse delaying that they would want to have a proper procedures. Procedures are there. What is it that they're afraid of? I think that's the issue that we've been talking about. And they knew well before, again, that the contract of Martha was not going to be renewed, and at that material time, they would have advertised the position and somebody would have been, you know, appointed who could have otherwise been understudying Martha. But unfortunately, all these things have not happened. And that's why some of us are really concerned with the fight against corruption, to say how serious are we as a nation?
What are the key qualifications do you think CSOs expect from the new Director General of the Anti-Corruption Bureau if the appointing authority, in this case the President, decides to choose a new person?
Definitely a new person will have to be chosen. And what sort of a person do we want? One, we would want to have a person who is really independent, who's so courageous, somebody that has got a personal integrity. I think that's very fundamental. The academic qualifications, I think that's a given fact. And we really want somebody who would not be biased towards one particular political party or, you know, any sort of an affiliation, you know, kind of. But we would want somebody that will be loyal to the state, you know, somebody that we can look up to when it comes to the fight against corruption, somebody that can coordinate, you know, the fight against corruption, you know, given the mandate of the Anti-Corruption Bureau. I think that's the kind of a person that we would want, so that he or she is accepted by the wider, you know, stakeholders, as opposed to only advancing the interest of one political institution or individual's interest.
Moses Nkandewire is the chairperson of the National Alliance Against Corruption. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. In the Gambia, Kemo Fati, a prominent environmentalist, says he plans to lead a youth movement as part of an effort to run in next year's presidential contest. Fati, who is also a youth advocate, says his campaign will focus on environmental protection, governance reform, and empowering the West African country's youth. This, as citizens demand a new constitution with new term limits for the president. The current constitution does not have limits, which allows incumbent President Adama Barrow to seek additional terms in office. Kemo Fati tells me that he is willing to form an alliance with other political parties and to have a youth-led administration to resolve the challenges facing the country.
Today, the Gambia is still depending on a 1997 constitution. Every time we have a new constitution draft, it doesn't go to the second reading. And this allows the Gambian people to participate. So the lawmakers should actually do their job and ensure that, you know, they let the Gambian people decide. And added to that as well, there are deeper problems that are affecting the whole entire system in the Gambia. For instance, you know, we have, you know, ministerial appointments that are really in charge of critical things that affect our future. But of course, there is no competence. So this is all jeopardizing the future of the Gambian people. This is the baseline for why I declared my candidacy. And essentially, I'm not hoping to say it is Kemo who's going to be in office, but the Gambia is 65% young people. So we are hoping that at least we should be able to have a youth candidate representing us, and that the president also should be aware that the Gambia is a young democracy, and we already saw what we have faced in 2016. Almost people started to flee into Senegal because of fear. So this is where my candidacy stands, is to support a youth-led government in power, whether it's me or someone else, but we are willing to build alliances across the whole country.
What are the three major issues you want the new constitution to address?
Right now, as we are speaking, you know, the Gambia, we are not confirming on time limits. Leaders are coming, and all the time, they are doing the same thing over and over again. And as well as, you know, one of the problems is that we are facing, you know, this simple majority. You know, the electoral process needs reforms, you know, so that we can put our democracy into play. These are all things that are very much critical in the new constitution that we are talking about. And, you know, the MPs should pay heed to this.
What should be the expectations of the people of the Gambia were they to decide that Kemo Fati will be the next president that they repose confidence in?
Well, one of the things is that, you know, we will have to redefine the way our food systems are working. Definitely speaking, the Gambia is now polluted with chemical fertilizers, our agriculture is not thriving, and our forest and biodiversity is depleting. From a country that used to be 100% forest, now we are crying for forest and food. I think that is a sobering reflection to every Gambian that whatever we do, our focus should be on protecting our natural resources and ensuring that, you know, we are food self-sufficient. I think this would be the first critical step for the Gambia in the pathway to prosperity.
Realistically, what do you think your chances are in defeating incumbent President Adama Barrow?
I think that will depend on the youth voice, because Kemo as an individual will not be in position to defeat already a sitting government. But there are 65% of young people. There will be a lot of young voters coming up in the 2026 election. This vote is actually sending a message to not just Adama Barrow, but all political parties. For over a generation, we have the same political parties with the same leaders. I am actually tasking them to bring forward a youth candidate so that we can see our dispensation, our democracy at work. But if they fail to do so, this will warrant Kemo to actually run for 2026, ensuring that there is a youth voice represented. But once there is a change from even Adama Barrow, the NPP party, bringing forward a youth candidate, this will automatically mean that my candidature or the idea behind me coming on board is already successful, and that the youth are taking tasks or responsibilities in the very own political parties they are. For so long, youth have been neglected in the Gambia's political dispensation. We always have a saying that, you know, politics is for failures and things like that. And these people are the ones deciding our tomorrow. So this is what I am actually putting across. I'm a representation of the young people of the Gambia, giving them a voice in the future, in the say against any decision that affects their future. So this is where I am actually trying to sell, so that we can build a national youth movement that can actually effect this change. Suppose that these parties are all clinging onto power and the same people are representing us for generations, and there is no competent person in their parties to represent, you know, them. So I think that should be even a reflection of a failure of their efforts. If you are leading a party, you should be able to have someone competent after years of being there. But the same people are keeping on running against election, and we the youth, we who are the majority of the of the population, we seem to be like not active in this. So I think these things should change. So this is the kind of idea that my candidacy is built on, not necessarily myself as an individual oosting, you know, the government, because at the end of the day, without the support of the youth, this cannot be possible.
Kemo Fati is a prominent environmentalist. He spoke with me from the Gambian capital, Banjul. In Nigeria, the Civil Society Legislative Advocacy Center, known as CISLAC, is calling for decisive governance and bold reforms to resolve tough economic conditions facing citizens. Awal Musa Rafsanjani is the executive director of CISLAC and the head of Transparency International Nigeria. He says authorities need to tackle corruption and financial wrongdoing to boost investor confidence. His remarks come as Nigerian opposition parties and civil society groups express concern about the economy. The removal of subsidies, they say, led to a sharp rise in prices of goods and services. They are calling on the government to quickly address the economic conditions. While Musa Rafsanjani tells me that Nigerians expect a transparent and accountable government to boost economic growth and living standards.
There is need for urgent radical reforms in order to restore responsible governance, in order to restore confidence on Nigerians about the administrative justice system, transparency and accountability, and inclusiveness in governance. So that is why CISLAC is making this call, because the level of insecurity in the country and the level of economic devastation in the country is making many Nigerians to suffer more and more. That is why CISLAC is making this bold call on government to, you know, ensure that it restores confidence on Nigerians, that the government is determined to ensure that it blocks leakages, it ensures that it brings programs that can bring, you know, immediate relief to Nigerians that are going through untold hardship in the country as a result of some bad policies and practices that government, you know, is implementing.
Talking about transparency and responsible governance, what specific issues do you think should be undertaken to address some of these challenges?
There are a number of issues that Nigeria must take in order to ensure that we block leakages. First and foremost, we need to block leakages. The level of looting and stealing and waste in Nigeria is what is making the country, you know, citizens to suffer more and more. One project kept aside and completely hijacked or diverted or wasted or looted or, you know, misappropriated, Nigerians suffer. Secondly, Nigeria is losing a lot from the oil theft. A lot of oil theft is going on without government taking drastic measure to deal with that. Thirdly, corruption, you know, is making the country to lose investors and to lose the citizens, you know, hope that they can be safe and protected in their country. So this is very dangerous. When investors, local and international, are leaving the country, it means that the number of people who are unemployed are in the increase, as we have seen. And the purchasing power is also very poor and very low. And the exchange rate is becoming like, unbearable to many people who want to, for example, want to do a lot of international trading, or want to pay school fees for their children, or want to pay medical bills, you know, abroad. So life has been very, very hard and difficult. Thirdly, the level of oil theft and the criminality that is making the revenue to dry, and also abuse in terms of tax waiver, tax holiday, you know, is also contributing to the difficulty that Nigerians are facing.
Awal, what about the issue of security? What is the current situation on the ground?
Every Nigerian knows that insecurity has created conditions for farmers not to go to farm. It has created conditions for many factories and manufacturers to close down and leave the country. So it is not a small thing, and it's not something that you can joke and pretend. It is something that you need to take drastic measure, holistic measure, to deal with the corruption in the security sector. It's very clear that, if government did not take necessary steps to, you know, prevent this criminal from having, you know, from possessing these arms, this terrorism will continue. And it is very clear to Nigerians that what is going on is not something that we should joke about or pretend about. It is something that is very important and very fundamental for government to work on to address this problem.
What are the expectations of Nigerians of the government this new year?
Well, the expectation of Nigerians largely is really to see how government can, you know, address some of the policies and the programs that they introduce that plunge them into this unnecessary hardship. Nigerians are expecting that government should do everything possible to bring some relief to them, because the hunger and starvation in the country is becoming incredible and unacceptable. And the level of also impunity and corruption and the abuse of due process is also, you know, something that Nigerians are hoping that something will be done in order to maintain, you know, a just society in the country.
Awal Musa Rafsanjani is the executive director of the Civil Society Legislative Advocacy Center and the head of Transparency International Nigeria. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. South Sudan announced early this week its plan to produce at least 90,000 barrels of crude oil a day as the country resumes national production. This comes after oil supply to international markets were cut off last February because of the ongoing conflict in Sudan. For VOA, Shirley Pony reports from Juba, South Sudan.
90% of South Sudan's gross domestic product, GDP, comes from its rich fossil reserves. In the past 11 months, the country was unable to sell its oil to international markets after Sudan evoked the force majeure clause, which protected it from liability following the outbreak of conflict in Khartoum in early 2023. The ban was lifted on January 4th, allowing neighboring South Sudan to resume production.
With the force majeure having been lifted, officially lifted by the government of Sudan through its letter, dated the 4th, 2025, and based on that, the Ministry of Petroleum and partners would like to declare that the kickoff date for DPOC resumption is as early as tomorrow. This is basically to say our D-Day that we have been waiting for is tomorrow, the 8th of January, 2025.
South Sudan's Minister of Petroleum, Port Kang Chol, is adamant that Juba will continue to pump more oil to the global market even as the work to replace fossil fuels with green energy picks up momentum.
We will continue to produce South Sudan, and not only South Sudan, the continent called Africa will continue to use oil resources for its own survival.
While Chol was making clear South Sudan's position on clean energy or lack of it, in Gudele, a suburb in the capital, Juba, Betty Yobu, a citizen, is battling a chronic heart condition due to prolonged exposure to toxic gases. Betty says she has been using charcoal stoves for the past 6 years at her restaurant, which targets low-income earners. The continuous exposure to carbon monoxide gases has made her health deteriorate.
I start feeling not okay, especially my chest because of the heavy work, no rest. My health become weak. Then I was thinking that maybe that is a heavy work. Then I decided to go and see doctor. Then they found that I developed a chest problem because of the firewood I was using, that dust, the charcoal, then the breathe in the carbon oxide, those things all affect my chest.
But Chol insists that Juba will use its resources for the betterment of its people.
We are faced with the reality. The reality is that I go hungry, I have no food, I will die. We are faced with the reality that you have a woman who have no access to health care, and the only resource that you have that can allow you to have health care is oil resources. We will not abandon it because death is death.
In 2022, the then finance minister Agak Achuil said that South Sudan's oil had been sold until 2027 and that any revenue coming from the sale of crude oil was going towards the repayment of loans. Agak later said he was misquoted. He was fired by President Salva Kiir within a week. Environmentalists continue to criticize the oil sector. In 2018, South Sudan lawmakers accused the Dar Petroleum Consortium, operating blocks 3 and 7, of dumping chemicals near Bentiu, home to an oil block. Joseph Africano Batal, Undersecretary, Ministry of Environment and Forestry in South Sudan.
For any operations to restart in Block 3 and 7, I think all environmental safeguards are supposed to be put in place.
Despite the challenges that will come with the latest pronouncement of plans to resume oil production, Juba and Khartoum are optimistic that it will alleviate a significant financial burden for both governments. South Sudan, which is ranked third in sub-Saharan Africa for oil reserves, produces approximately 3.5 billion barrels annually. Sheila Oponi for VOA News, Juba, South Sudan.
The Southern African nation of Eswatini has secured continued eligibility for benefits under the U.S. African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA, for 39 companies currently trading under AGOA, including some of Eswatini's biggest brands. U.S. Trade Representative spokesman Samuel Michel confirmed Eswatini's eligibility in late December. Eswatini's exclusion from the trade agreement in 2015 followed the country's failure to meet benchmarks for democratization and respect for human rights and highlighted how the country's political situation negatively impacted the country's economy. For VOA, Nukuka Nyamusi reports from the Eswatini capital, Mbabani.
In a written statement issued on December 21, U.S. Trade Representative spokesman Sam Mitchell said the decision to continue Eswatini's participation in the African Growth and Opportunity Act was based on an annual AGOA eligibility review, which concluded that the list of eligible and ineligible countries will remain unchanged for 2025. Eswatini, an AGOA member for 23 years, exported some $23.5 million worth of goods in 2022. It is among more than 30 African nations, including Namibia, South Africa, and Mozambique, eligible for the U.S.-led trade initiative aimed at boosting trade and economic ties between the United States and Africa through duty-free access. Swazi businesswoman Sonia Paiva emphasized the importance of international trade agreements to grow businesses in Eswatini, citing the benefits of import duty removal and increased market access. She said that exclusion from such agreements could have detrimental economic implications for businesses and citizens.
We cannot afford to be excluded from such agreements, as the country faces the highest unemployment rate to date, which affects over 50% of our population, which are mainly youth. We hereby continue to motivate our government to effectively put policies into place that will protect export businesses. With policies in place, trade agreements should be easier monitored for its compliance and implementation.
Eswatini was temporarily suspended from AGOA in 2015 due to failure to meet benchmarks in democratization and human rights. The suspension resulted in thousands of job losses. However, the country was reinstated in 2017, reinvigorating its economic prospects and reinstating its eligibility for duty-free access to the U.S. market. Wandile Dlulu, the deputy president of the opposition, People's United Democratic Movement, PUDEMO, expressed disappointment at the renewal of AGOA benefits to Eswatini, stating that the country's government continues to disregard the rule of law, arrest political activists, and obstruct an international investigation into the assassination of human rights activist Tulan Masego.
We have MPs who are languishing in jail and have been convicted on the basis of the Suppression of Terrorism Act, for which not only was copied from the American version, but has been greatly supported by the same American government. And in our context, it is being used as a bowie knife against pro-democracy forces and human rights activists. And we think it's very much an inconsistency on the part of the government of the US. We have a very hostile political environment wherein the same government that they are opening markets to have refused to engage or allow international community to conduct an independent investigation on the matter.
Sibusiso Nhlabathi, a political analyst, criticized the renewal of AGOA benefits for Eswatini, also known as Swaziland. He argues that the American government's decision disregards the Eswatini's unfulfilled commitments highlighted in the enduring political instability in Eswatini and the absence of a promised national dialogue to address the issues.
The Americans are not as strict as they should when they apply these AGOA benchmarks on the Kingdom of Swaziland. But the political situation in Swaziland, regardless of the fact that they renew these AGOA benefits, which is of course beneficial to certain business people, but the political climax in Swaziland will never be the same post 2021, and it is also disingenuous on the part of the American because there are commitments that the king made during the unrest, the commitment for dialogue, and this was even budgeted for. But the dialogue has not taken place yet.
Eswatini government spokesperson Alpheus Nxumalo has reaffirmed Eswatini's commitment to comply with all AGOA requirements and maintain strong diplomatic ties with the U.S. government. Nokukhanya Musi, VOA News, Mbabane, Eswatini.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Necessary, necessary, caro caro, new story, Thank you to Trinidad. Pick up the will of them. Come on, get in, no idea. Anything I do. Headline news, if you waiting, I no do. Then go say I do. Nothing but the truth, and I step up in the booth. No lie, my life, no be smarting. Remember last Christmas, Santa Claus gave me the glizzy with the switch dog. So some people no go see this Christmas. Man, them a grasses, most of them not even Christians. Click bang, body sinking at the quicksand. See tech full of bomb like Afghanistan. And if you make guy come in, know the enemy, them a pray. I mean, no, they're not sorry for me. People are ball and a skin, can we bad than we mean? Bloody crime scene, calamity. I saw we shoot up, we and figure Canada G. Make them have a experience, no gravity. Tell them we not laugh up, we not dead dog. Violate people are dead dog. Should I keep in your bed, cause the Taliban's them a make work. We not laugh up, we not dead dog.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mogwili Abaru, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, those who sit patiently with the elders under the moonlight at the village square will drink from the wisdom of knowledge. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.
So me buy 6 more. What's the plan? Cause I'm real to my skeleton. If you insult my intelligence, then I make the sparks fly.